Yes.
Okay, it's 4:02, and I'd like to bring the Environmental Services Advisory Committee meeting to order. Let's see, let's start out with roll call. And we're back to 7 members again, so that's pretty exciting. Margo Garcia.
Here.
Haley is here.
Here.
Doug.
Here.
Trevor.
Here.
Susanna.
Here.
Hi, Ryan.
Hello, I am also here.
Oh, good. Okay. And Chris Yarder present. Not meaning to put you on the spot, Haley, but would you like to just tell us about you a little bit? And
Yeah, and no worries. I know it's like deceptive with the Y, but it's pronounced Hallie, like Halle Berry.
oh, I'm
Hallie Ryan
sorry.
Sally.
Okay.
No worries. My parents cursed me with that Y. Yeah, so I'm a native Tucsonan, third generation. I graduated from the U of A with my bachelor's and my master's, and now I'm working at Visit Tucson as a sustainability manager. So I really love the city of Tucson, and I've always wanted to work with people who love Tucson and want to make Tucson better. So that is delightful. I love my job and now I get to contribute civilly. So I'm super excited to be a part of
Okay, welcome.
Yes.
All right. Let's move to item two, director's report. Carlos, you're going to start out with the ADEQ proposed solid waste fees
Okay, thank you. Well, good afternoon,
increases.
everybody. Earlier in the year, at the beginning of the year, ADEQ has been reaching out in terms of their proposed ADEQ solid waste fees. Essentially, what the intent of it is really ADEQ, the way they fund, they want to fund it almost like an enterprise account, and they want to be able to collect the fees to be able to sustain most of the programs, especially in this as it relates to solid waste fee, is really how can they support their solid waste program. There's been a few opportunities really for cities and towns really to present essentially their concerns. So back in July, we expressed or we submitted some concerns related to the solid waste fees. There's a series of fees ranging from just permit fees for a new facility plan. Anytime we make amendments to a facility, it's a big range of fees. Some of them range essentially from 10 to 50%, all the way to almost over 100% in changes in terms of the fees. So where we think the most of the impact is going to be for us is really the disposal fee that they charge us. So we have to, that we essentially have to pay DEQ for that fee. And this is, again, this is solid waste disposal fee. So that in a sense, right now the fee is 25 cents per ton, and it's going to go up to essentially 58 cents per ton. So right now, we dispose about 700,000 tons at the landfill, so per year. So the impact that we would have to make the change is about $250,000, $250,000 in there. So that's certainly going to be an impact because that we haven't adjusted our landfill fees really to accommodate that. So that's something that we need to get ourselves in line and prepared really to absorb that hit. As part of our concerns, we cited that as an impact. We also cited, as you know, the state essentially imposed or a some reductions in station revenue that the city has been impacted for several million dollars. I don't have the exact number, but it's over, I think for this year is over $30 million that the city had to absorb in reductions of state share revenue. So that's something that in addition to the cities were hit, especially Tucson and some of the major cities, this is an addition to is not only in terms of reducing revenue that goes to the cities, but also increase in the fees that are charged to the cities. They're also in the recommendations is they're plugging in what is called a CPI adjustment, okay? And this is consumer price index adjustment. That essentially there is no cap in terms of how far they're going to go with those adjustments. Those are going to be adjusted annually, and there is really no sunset for those CPI adjustments. So if those once those fees go into effect, they're essentially if the following year there's a CPI adjustment, then they're going to just tag along that adjustment and don't have to go back and really seek any public comment regarding those increases. So obviously the cities are opposed to that, because if you are using the principle of being a enterprise account and this is based on a cost of service, you just really don't apply a CPI adjustment really just to increase fees. And also the CPI adjustment is a general consumer price index. It's not really based on just the waste and recycling adjustment index. So that's the other concern that we have essentially outlined for them. Also, we asked them really to move forward with implementing those fee increases July 1st of 2025. That's essentially when the cities essentially in line with the vast majority of the cities budget cycle. And then the other thing we asked and we recommended is why can't we just implement those fees over a 3 to 5 year period? So again, we submitted comments at the department level, submitted comments during the public period, submitted comments throughout essentially the city, and I don't think there's any deviation from what they're essentially are trying to implement the beginning of the year. So that's really kind of where we're at on that. So ultimately, is going to be an impact. The substantial impact is going to be our landfill disposal fees. Again, the impact is about $250,000 to $252,000. Kind of on the side note, in terms of where we at overall, as it relates to fees, the city manager's office has asked us really to put together, to work this essentially this year in assembling an updated our cost of service study throughout the department, throughout the fund. So we're barely getting that going with the intent of really putting together more of a formalized rate adjustment or rate review in calendar year 2025, and be in a position really to present to the council some sort of a proposed rate modifications for calendar year 2025. That concludes my remarks as it relates to that topic.
Are there any questions for Carlos?
I believe okay. I saw some of those regulations come through. It seems to me there were other kinds of fees too, or are we just worried about the landfill fee?
The vast majority of it is landfill fees. There's other stuff that's certainly going to be an impact. So say, for instance, if we need to submit a permit review for our facility plan. So right now, we essentially pay roughly about $12,000. They're recommending that fee go up to $20,000. That is a significant increase from $12,000 to $20,000. It's almost a 60% increase, but we don't do that every day. Okay. And also when we review our financial responsibility for operating landfills, that's also an annual fee. That's essentially goes from $600 to almost $900. So those are essentially big increases, but they're one time, and we don't do those. Some of them, we don't do them every year. Some of them do, but it's really not as impactful as essentially the disposal fee.
So what is your timetable for looking at you're doing this cost of service again. Have you started it now? Is it going to go until 1st of January? How are you thinking about the time?
So we just barely issued the notice to proceed to the consultant, which has been the same consultant, NewGen, who's helped us out in the previous studies. So the timeline really to conduct and finish that study is about 6 month period. We may want to couple that, and that's still on the works, is doing an operating review of the department as a whole. As we all know, Tucson has grown. And so we need to add some other resources really to cover some of the areas. So that's really taking a look at how we're operating. What do we, are we flush? Do we need to add more resources? How do we compare to other similar cities? And really do that comparative analysis that would essentially would be used as a way to essentially back up our request, review our capital outlay program, review our capital improvements program, and really allow us really to put some money forward for those zero waste initiatives.
So, do you see the finance committee getting together like in May of next year or
Yes, absolutely. Yes.
next month? Okay.
Yes. And we may just want may want to schedule kind of an interim meeting before we get to kind of with somewhere in the middle of the road. Just to, so once we essentially find just kind of like they're gonna get the basic information, they're gonna start putting some of those analysis. So it'd probably be worthwhile really for us to sit down and go over those preliminary findings before we get too far into the game.
So maybe March, February.
Yes, I believe so. Yes.
When did you say that ADEQ is doing the increase, or are they proposing it, you said?
January 1st, 2025.
Oh, shortly here. Okay.
Okay, any other questions? All right. We'll move on then, Carlos, to the brush and bulky on demand.
Thank you. So over the past few years, I think last time that we had some delays in our brush and bulky program was around 2021, I believe, and it was around the same time frame. So let me just give you a little bit of background to that. Since October 13th, we've been on what we call mandatory overtime, and as a result of that is really it was a perfect combination. One, short staff, two, equipment being down, and third, essentially some areas that pressure bulk areas have been very, very heavy. And what I mean heavy is it's really a lot of set outs, okay, a lot of people putting out stuff, and not only the volume, but the number of folks essentially that putting stuff out for collection. We also that we were seeing a little bit of more of an increase at the end of the summer, really resulting really from storm damage in kind of the south, kind of in the southwest, northwest part of town. And that's where we some of the monsoons were very heavy in that area. So we started seeing a lot of green material, green waste material, and a lot of construction debris as well. So like siding, 2x4s. So we saw an increase in that. And so as we progressed and we combined that with the short staff, we had equipment down as well and heavy, it really put us behind for about 2 weeks behind schedule. And so as of October 13, we started the week of October 13, I believe it was the second week in October, we kicked in really into mandatory overtime. Right now, we're basically about 3 to 4 days behind. So that's where we're at. So one of the things that we're looking at that is if we look at the tonnage across every week, we essentially are looking that some areas we or every week we pick up around 250 tons of material. Some areas sometimes it peaks up almost to 600 tons a week. So it's a very big swing in terms of tonnages. So one of the things we were looking at that is there any really possibility for us to attenuate or even now the tonnage by really implementing and moving forward with an on-demand brush and bulky program. Still provide the public with essentially 2 pickups a year, but being able for the public really to schedule those pickups at their convenience. And then also for us would be more convenient so we can essentially schedule the crews and really have a better control of the volume rather than just being hit in specific areas very heavily. In some other areas, there were very, very not as much material being placed out of the curve. So as you know, Phoenix, we know a person over there that is very well connected with the program. They move forward and implement the Depression on Demand program back in October. What I hear and had some discussions with him, with Pat, over the past couple months, and he says that it's working fine. There's some tweaks that obviously they're making some tweaks to the program, but it's working okay. I'd also reach out also to the director in Austin, and they're essentially are putting together, they're going to deploy the program the beginning of the year. Very similar in nature to Phoenix, very similar in nature to what we're thinking as well. So obviously there's a lot of concerns really from our elected officials in terms of if we have a program that is very popular, people, the public really look forward to this program, why are we suggesting to change that? So our response to that is it works in some areas and it doesn't work in some areas because of how heavy they are. And so that's one. And it's not a matter of us really just, one of the solutions could be is for us to add more trucks, for us to add more crews. And that will be great if we had an ability really to onboard people as we need them. So we still run recruitments. We still, it still really becomes to be a hard to fill position. Right now, I think we're around 77 vacant positions. So when you look at seven vacant positions, that equates to about two Russian bulky crews roughly. And so we haven't really gotten to the point that we're flush with personnel, or we are in a position really to overhire just so that we can anticipate any potential retirements, people leaving the city, or just over turnover. We haven't gotten to that point. So it's not a function of really having available from a budget perspective additional budget capacity. And so the function is not having enough applicants, enough people really not only sustain the current vacancies, but also anticipate the turnover that we experience on a regular basis. The equipment also becomes to be a factor. So it's not a function of really, well, can we buy additional trucks? We can, but I think the function is really that we order trucks almost 2 years ago and we still have not received them. So it really becomes to be an issue that we just can't continue to operate the way we are. And if obviously we can continue to make ends meet with the personnel, with the equipment that we have. So it's really trying to find another way on how we can essentially deliver the service in a different way. So obviously, again, the concern for mayor and council is, well, it's working. Can we do something about it? So one of the things that we're proposing, and we still are running into a little bit of opposition, is can you at least give us an opportunity? And that's what the department's asking. Can you give us an opportunity really to test this on-demand program in two areas? Okay. And those two areas would be Area 25, which is essentially the area generally southwest of the main intersection of Valencia and Old Nogales Highway. So essentially west of the airport. North of the Indian Reservation, so that's Area 25. And the reason why we selected that area is heavily hit by illegal dumping from residents coming in from the county. So when we see empty lots, folks just knowing that there's no homes, they go out there and essentially dump their materials from their cleanup outside the county, come and bring it, drop it in there. And so that really creates more material that we have to pick up in that particular area. Residents get upset, and you probably saw the news article, or the news, I believe it was Channel 9 that covered the story a couple weeks ago, and some of the residents expressing concerns. We made contact with those residents, and essentially what happens is they know that they become to be a dumping ground for folks that don't have the services outside the county, outside the city. And so the idea, if no longer we have a scheduled date for us to have Russian bulky pickup in the area, it really becomes to be on demand. It can we at least give it a try and see if it really cuts back not only in the tonnage, but the amount of legal dumping that can come in from the county. So that's area 25. The other area that we, ideally for us, we would like to have at least four areas from a pilot program in all four quadrants of the city. But essentially, but right now for the moment, we're just focusing on or asking really for us to be given the ability to try those out in those two areas. The other area is area 19. And that's generally, as I recall, Speedway and Harrison, somewhere around that area, area 19. The reason for that is Ward 4, essentially every year, they essentially get a lot of calls from the residents, especially in the Rita Ranch area, that why are we having brush and bulky pickup around Halloween? It is very unsafe. It looks very, the neighborhoods look very blighted, and they really don't want us to, and or the holidays, and they see those piles out there. And so they ask us, what can we do about it? I said, one is that we can't, even if we said we're not going to do pickup on a holiday week, we know folks put things out a couple of weeks or more than that. So then that becomes to be a challenge. If we stop the program for a week, someone needs to be affected. It may not be somebody in Ward 4, but somebody may be affected on us not having a pickup for a particular week. So that has been the challenge for us, that we can't stop the program. We're tight as it is on, because we're our spread out in 26 areas. There's 52 weeks out of the year. You get picked up twice a year. So that's essentially where it becomes to be the 52, the magical 52 weeks out of the year. So again, the working with them, working with the neighborhood associations, can we give it a try in an area that is more of a formalized subdivision, a new type of land use, newer neighborhoods? Are we interested in really deploying this program on demand so that we can curtail really the amount of piles that we'll be seeing out and about in particular neighborhoods? And it would really, again, be more convenient for the public to do it at their convenience. And probably not. Some neighborhoods are essentially, their week is in the middle of June. Well, we know what happens in June. It's very hot. And is that really the best way really for the public to be putting their material out, as well as our crews being out there in the middle of the summer? So with all those heat stress mitigation strategies the city's trying to deploy, that's another factor that we're trying to see if there's any opportunity for us to kill two birds with one stone. So that's where we're at right now. So we put it, Christina put together a white paper with some information. We have forwarded that to the city manager's office. They're in the process of reviewing that and see if they give us essentially the nod to move forward. One of the key components that is important is what kind of metrics are we going to put out there in terms of evaluating the program. So just to name a few, we'll look at the number of set outs in, again, being on a regular scheduled B&B schedule as compared to on demand. So how many folks did put something out in those two areas? And then we're actually picking up or gathering the information for this area, for area 19 and area 25, to give us an idea of the tonnage, how many people put stuff out there on the current program, the as is. And we're also going to collect the information for the following year. How many of the B&B pickups that we're doing illegal in area 25 can we attribute it really to illegal dumping? How many B&B on-demand requests do we get as compared to really what we traditionally see in every neighborhood in terms of set out rates? How many complaints do we get related to no B&B services in the pilot areas? And how many people actually participated? What was essentially the tonnage that was generated in 25 versus in 2024? How many legal work orders did we generate in area 25 as compared to in calendar year 25 as compared to previous years? And then just looking at essentially the tonnage comparison. So every week, our staff, our collection staff in Brush and Bulky, they collect all the tickets, and they know essentially how much, what was the tonnage that was collected every single week. in a particular area. And the other thing is we'll do our best really to make a distinction in terms of the operation and financial comparative analysis between fiscal year 24 and 25 as it relates to really the deployment of the program. So again, where we are today is put the white paper, Christina put together the white paper for CMO's reviews. They're in the process of reviewing that. We're hoping that we would get the nod really to give it a try on those two areas. We'll give it a test and see if there's any merits for us. Let's see what we learn and see if we could be in a position really to transition into an on-demand program in 26. So that's really kind of the purpose and intent of this item. So that concludes my remarks.
Okay. Thank you. Any questions about the on demand that's coming? And Brittany did send the link to that interview Christina had about the illegal dumping. And I know Jose talked to us about it in our subcommittee meeting. And you really have to see it to believe it. It's just it's just mounds, and also they're not following the rules. So there's toxic things that are being dumped as well. So sounds good.
So you would envision this that somebody would call in and say, next week I'm going to have a pile out, and then you would schedule, you know, make the routes for the trucks to go pick it up. And then somehow you would tag that it only happens twice a year, so people aren't calling in three and four times a year.
Yes, Ms. Fargo, yes, that will be the intent. Mm-hmm. Again, very similar in nature to what Phoenix has deployed, very similar in nature to essentially what Austin is going to do. So one of the things that we were thinking is, obviously, we don't want to be driving around town all the time. So essentially, we would do those pickups in by areas, and we would really try to schedule folks so that we're servicing a particular area, most likely the same service day as your garbage service. So we'll assign a week. So it said, hey, well, got it. We got your request. You call it in, and we'll give you when we're scheduled to go pick it up. So that gives you at least part of the education would be is when you call us, then most likely we'll need a couple weeks window to be able to go out there and service it. So if you call it in today, that doesn't mean we're going to be out there tomorrow. So that those are some of the things that we need to look at it from an education and outreach perspective, and so that we can work it backwards from that end in terms of how we may be out there again, because the whole thing, we just don't want to be driving around all different areas on from the east going to the west. It's really just very, very, we'll follow the same pattern as what we do with garbage collection. So our crews will be going to be working in the same general area, picking up while we pick up garbage.
How do you intend to communicate that it's going to be someone's area in a certain week?
So for the pilot program, yes. So Will, the intent is, it would be that we would reach out to them, and we'll send them a mailer and say, we'll inform them about the program. We would basically, not only a letter, but we'll have folks that are going to be more in contact with those residents, not only the neighborhood associations, but residents if questions come in. So we need to equip ourselves to make sure that we have more of a direct communication with the public. So questions like that do come up, for us to be able to answer and schedule them appropriately and provide the services appropriately. So it's going to require a lot more work behind the scenes to make sure that folks don't feel that they're not supported. And we just want to make sure that there is a clear avenue for them to be in contact with it. Not generally as a whole, just for the folks that are going to be part of the pilot area.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Thank you.
Hey. If there's no more questions, and thank you, Carlos.
Thank you.
Okay. Let's move on to the food cycle at home, item three.
Hi, Brittany, do you have the slides?
I do. I'm bringing it up now.
Thank you. Hi everyone, I'm Lisa Rotello. I'm going to provide an update on our residential food cycle at home program. In January of this year, we began the program. It's a voluntary program. We partnered with the Community Gardens of Tucson. We felt like that was a natural fit to support the circular economy. That's a different slide. Okay. We partnered with the Community Gardens of Tucson. We felt like it was a natural fit. We also have partnered with Tucson Clean and Beautiful, and the Compost Cats at the University of Arizona have helped to support our program as well. When we started the program, we knew we needed to take steps to minimize contamination. We decided to provide locked containers at the six sites that were established. And we also require all participants to attend trainings. To date, all the trainings have been in person. The reason we wanted to do the trainings are because, as we all know, programs across the country differ. Some, what is accepted in Seattle's compost program may not be accepted in our arid climate here in Tucson. This has, at the completion of the training, the participants are then given the lock code to the bin. We've asked the participants not to share the code. We didn't know how that would come across, but to date, it's been successful. There has been minimum contamination. During the trainings, we also provide all the participants countertop food waste containers. They can use containers that are larger as they see fit. Go ahead to the next slide, Brittany. When we go through the training, we talk about what is accepted, what isn't accepted within the program, and also address any questions that our participants have. Next slide. We now have 9 locations. When we first started off, as I mentioned, we had 6. We now have 9 locations, and we are about to add 5 more. The Compost Cats have actually partnered with our program, so we'll be adding 2 of their locations as drop-off sites, as well as 2 to 3 additional sites at parks. Next slide. Our participation or our volume has increased. It's still low. We started off in January with a little over 1 ton of food waste collected. And as you see, each month it's continued to grow. We're at about 4.5 tons now. Our biggest challenge has been the trainings. The attendance for the training have been just remarkable. All the classes have been full. We sometimes have to schedule back-to-back classes because the participation has been extraordinary. Next slide. To date, we've collected, since January 1st, over 25 tons of food waste, which is a 347% increase. We have also, in addition to collecting the food waste, the participants of the program have the option to receive free compost and mulch. We have returned over 300 tons of compost back to the community. We are distributing compost through the community gardens, as well as the community gardens. We are providing them to different schools throughout the community. TUSD has been really receptive to our compost. The University of Arizona has also started accepting our compost, and we also distribute to the community through ward offices. We have such demand for our compost on a regular basis. There has been no concern or issue with distributing the compost to date. We are holding our first virtual training next week. We are hoping this will help address some of our training issues so we can reach more of the community. To date, we have over 1,400 participants, and our training for next week, we already have 82 people signed up. So we're really looking forward to that training. Compost Cats also, I'm happy to say, with their program partnering with ours, they also are going to support us in training to the community, and we're looking forward to that. We survey our participants asking for feedback. If there are any issues or questions, they can address us through our email account, our Food Cycle at Home email address. If they ever have questions about what can be added into their collection program, if there's concerns about the containers, then that email is checked on a daily basis. We also provide our participants a newsletter to keep them updated as we grow the program, as we add additional sites, or if we do any special training. Some of the trainings we've done to date that have really, we've enjoyed, Tucson Community Center asked us to do a special training for their staff. This is a residential program, but the intent was for their staff to participate at home. And we had probably close to 100 people attend that training. In addition, we've done two trainings at the zoo, and the participants had a free day at the zoo after the training, and they also had an animal encounter. That went over very well. We have another training scheduled for the zoo in January. So that's kind of an update of where we are, where we're going. We're looking to grow the program. We are continuing to add sites and looking for additional ways to provide training to the community. I'm going to turn it over to Jose Garcia, who is working at the landfill, and he can talk a little bit about the process of our compost.
Good afternoon, everyone. My name is Jose Garcia. I'm an environmental services inspector for the city of Tucson, based out of the Los Reales Sustainability Campus. I'm not sure, Brittany, I think there was a couple more slides in that slide deck that Lisa had sent you. I don't know if you could, just to have some visuals for people. Like Lisa is saying, with the addition of the Food Cycle at Home food waste stream at the start of this year, at the compost facility here at Los Reales, we're processing anywhere from 8 to 12 tons of organic material. That is between the manure that we recycle from the herbivores at Reed Park Zoo, as well as the food waste from Food Cycle at Home, as well as the Food Cycle commercial collection program. So we process that amount, and in addition of 40 to 60 tons of diverted green waste from our landfill. We started that program, because it's not a full-fledged program, but we started those activities here at Los Reales at the landfill, where a lot of those self-haul residents, arborists, local landscape companies are diverted to a separate drop-off area. And if they have clean green waste, they're sent to one section. If they have green waste that has maybe some trash in it, they're sent to another section where our staff is able to clean that up and reutilize it. Last year, we processed 1,040 tons of that green waste, and this year we're headed upwards of 3,000 tons of diverted green waste. A lot of it is being used to fuel our compost facility, and any excess of that is being used for on-site as just erosion control for stormwater and on our landfill slopes. Aside from that, We are following, you know, with the compost donations that we are doing, donating more than 300 tons just this year. We have been following United States Composting Council STA requirements, making sure that it is a safe and quality product that we're pushing out into our community. So we conduct, with the help of the University of Arizona's Compost Cats, they help us with lab testing, making sure that that material, that compost that we're sending out is safe for everyone and for plants and for the environment. That's all the updates I have.
I'm sorry, Jose. I didn't get that
No
email.
worries.
I had the wrong presentation, so.
Awesome. Something I'll plug in real quick. If anyone is interested in, because not that many people know that the city of Tucson operates their own composting facility. You can probably reach out here to the landfill, and we're always offering tours of the compost facility and the landfill itself. I'm more than welcome to share with any with people information about the composting facility and all of our processes there. So thank you, everyone. I think there's maybe some questions.
Thank you. Any questions for Jose?
Well, I just wanted to say, I think Jose was, those of us who were on the tour on the 31st on Halloween, met up with some of the
Right.
environmental inspectors, and that was very nice to see them there and explaining what they did and how they had to put on big boots and wade into the organic food to pull out gloves and styrofoam cups and things that people put in. You can see something white in that particular one that they would have to take out.
Yes.
As we wondered what they were inspecting, well, they let us know. And the biggest problem is the stickers on the vegetables. Please take all the stickers off before you compost. That's a
Anyone
funny
else?
thing.
Boy, it's gotten a lot bigger than when it first started. For sure.
That's for sure.
That's exciting. Yeah. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank
Kristen.
you, everyone.
Yeah, that was great. Thank you, both of you.
Chris, may I
Yeah.
say something?
Oh, sure.
Thank you. So what Lisa and Jose just covered, this is really just, again, the startup and the pilot program of the food cycle at home. So what we're in the process of really formalizing essentially that program and really no longer calling it a pilot program. So it's really, and what I mean by formalizing that, and both of them essentially alluded to it, is really not only expanding the sites in terms of the collection sites, but so for us to do to augment the pickup, and so that we'd really make it more convenient for the public really to access those sites. So we start off with six, now nine, and then for nine at an additional five. So we're looking at what the expansion will look like, very similar in nature, to be able to make sure that there is a drop-off site anywhere between a couple miles or within a mile from anybody's residence. So we're looking at those possible locations. We're looking at the possible equipment, what those bins will look like, whether they're locked, whether they're probably most likely going to be locked, whether you do it through an app or you do it through a code. So we're going through that as well. And that's kind of more on the collection sites. And so then at the landfill, it's really moving forward and really making some investments in the actual processing of the not only the green waste but also the food waste, and really moving forward with an aerated static pile processing at the landfill, more of a mechanical infused system to accelerate the compost, the material, the compost of the material. So that way we can be really more into a more formalized green diversion program. So talked about a little bit of brush and bulking demand. So we're looking at how can we collect a lot more of green waste at the curb, and not only at the landfill, just like was Jose mentioned earlier, formalize that as well at the landfill, but how do we improve essentially access to waste diversion at the curb? Again, very at a small scale, still not replacing brush and bulky, but really giving folks the ability really to dispose of the green waste so that we can use it for our composting. And as Lisa pointed out as well, we have had a lot of interest for the composting material. It is really, really a very, very good material and really is a testament of the work that Jose is doing out there at the landfill, the outreach that is going on and the participation, but also really the help that we get from the compost cats in terms of the quality control. So it really, truly is a very, I would say, three-way partnership in terms of really the program itself. So I think we have a very good foundation. I think it's been accepted well. Now it's really a function of how do we deploy so that was more accessible to the public and really we can begin to collect more food waste. So on average, it's anywhere between 200 to 220, 230 pounds of food waste that essentially that we generate per year per capita. So that just gives us numbers in terms of the amount, and we're not even at the tip of the iceberg in terms of we're really trying to divert a lot of the food waste that we could be diverting from the landfill. So more is to come in terms of really the expansion of the program, formalizing the program, make it more available. You're probably going to see a lot more bins out and about. There's going to be a lot of noise around that as well, and really having the accessibility to be able to have folks really participating to the program. That's it. Thank you.
That's great. Good news. Thank you. All right. Let's move on then to item four for the brownfields update. And Frank, I see you.
Yeah.
You had another meeting with us.
I'll give an update on brownfields. Actually, I'll get several other updates. But just to start off on brownfields, the brownfields program. In 2018, we applied for a grant for brownfields, basically to do environmental site assessments. We picked a corridor, which was primarily the La Dulce, 12th Avenue. That grant was $300,000. It went through a couple of extensions, but we just ended up closing this grant at the end of June. We spent it. This grant actually was with us when we went through COVID, which was part of the reason why we had to request additional extensions of it. So we were able to spend as much as possible. We ended up spending around $298,000 roughly of it. So we were very close. And some of the accomplishments for that is that we completed a brownfields inventory and community health assessments for two locations, which was one was La Dulce. And then halfway through the grant, we added another corridor because the activities at La Dulce were kind of slow. So then we moved on. So we added a location right in the 05 area. At the end of the grant period, we ended up with 18 phase one environmental site assessments. And phase one site assessments are basically looking at the property to see if there's any potential contamination or concerns, what they're called wrecks. And then after we also completed seven phase twos, and phase twos, that's where we get more into maybe doing some sampling of the soils or looking at potential encroachment of vapors into buildings. Or if it's going to be redeveloped, we want to ensure that none of those vapors would go into the new buildings that would go in there. We did seven of those phase twos, and we also did four asbestos containing materials and lead-based paint surveys and assessments for quarried sites. I want to point out that from all these assessments that we did, some of those included, we worked with the housing department for some transitional housing. Some of those are Milagro and Oracle. And if you're familiar with that one, it's the previous no-tell motel the Sugar Hill on Stone, which was a previous Bumpster restaurant, if you're familiar with that one. Menlo Park was also included. There's an Econo Lodge on Stone that we also completed a phase one assessment through the grant that we had. And then additionally, four properties on the corner of Speedway and Stone. So all of these properties will be redeveloped by housing and community development into some sort of transitional housing or affordable housing for the community. So our grant complemented well with what housing is doing and their activities. In 2022, we applied for another loan. It's a Brownfields Revolving Loan Fund. And this one is to, it's basically what it is. It's a fund where we can offer loans and give subgrants to properties that need remediation, that have contaminants, known contaminants, and we need to do some sort of remediation. That grant amount was for $1 million. And there's a cost share in the City of Tucson Environmental General Services for $214,000. And most of that cost share can be staff time that we can use to meet that cost share. We've spent very little on it right now. Maybe around $17,000. And then we've also spent about $41,000 on staff time. So it's coming up slow, mostly because this grant, we have to set up the entire loan program. We had to also contract with a company that would manage the loans, do all, because it's a lot of legal information as far as when you're issuing a loan. And then that company will also manage the loan and the payments as they come in and ensuring that the loans are paid back. The funds that come back into the program will then be reused. So it's basically a revolving fund where it's a low interest loans that those would be. And they could be down to 0%, up to 3%, or up to whatever the market is. But it's an incentive so that we can remediate and get some of these properties that have contaminants and get them back into redevelopment. As I mentioned, we've almost set up the entire program, and we're in the process and getting ready to start issuing some loans and some subgrants. Additionally, as part of the Brownfields program, we've been able to work with the state to secure some additional funding outside of whatever grants there is. We work with the state, and there's one grant, it's about $15,000, that we secured for the Dunbar Pavilion cleanup and redevelopment. They found that there's asbestos at that site, so they have to do an abatement. The state stepped in and they want to provide the funding for that to happen. Another one is we've been working with directly with EPA, which is called a Targeted Brownfields Assessment Grant. So this is our funds that come to the city. Those go directly. EPA issues those funds to, or they contract with a contractor, with a company that comes into Tucson to a facility or a site, and they do all the assessments. This one that we applied for was for the Midtown Farm. If you're familiar with the Julia Keene Elementary School, that school is closed, but now it's being managed as a community center, a farm where they're actually growing food and they have animals there. The total of that grant was $100,000. So they're still in the process. That takes about a year. for that whole project to complete. Another Brownfields grant that was secured was for the Southwest Folklife Alliance. And that was basically to do an asbestos and lead-based paint survey. And then finally, another grant that for the South 10th Avenue site, and I think you may have heard of South 10th, is a property that housing and community development will redevelop into potentially mixed income housing. The amount of that grant is not known yet, but this grant, specific grant, comes also directly from the EPA. It's a land revitalization technical assistance, and they will help them plan what the site will look like and basically see it through development. They don't include any development funds, it's basically just to do the planning. And then finally, we applied, this has just happened about a couple of days ago, we submitted the application for a 2025 Brownfields Assessment Grant. Because we just closed one, we're applying for this grant so that we can start, or we can continue to do the assessments or assessments in Tucson and again, certain targeted areas. Thrive in the Old Five is another targeted area that we're including the new grant. And then a lot of the downtown area that's going to be included as well. That one is for $500,000 if we receive it. Again, as I mentioned, that grant was just submitted a couple of days ago. That's all I have on Brownfields.
Thank you. Are there any questions? Okay. Frank, are you going to do item five for the pump and treat?
I will. And Brittany, can you allow me to share my screen?
Chris, Mr. Chairman, before we get going with that one of the things that if you notice on the agenda, we missed to place the financial report.
Yes, I saw
this. So obviously we can't discuss, can't cover it because it's not on the agenda. So what we will do is really just send you via email and or a copy of that report, and then obviously so that you have the information for this month. And then we'll cover it next month as well. Okay. So if there's any members of the public that really are interested in that, if you could just let Brittany know, then we can certainly send you a copy of that report as well. And then we can discuss it at our next meeting in December.
Okay. Yeah. We did get them.
Oh. Okay. You did get them. Okay. Okay.
Yeah. We did get them. So.
Okay. So you got them on the agenda. But again, because we didn't put on the agenda, I missed that putting on the agenda. So obviously we can't discuss it, but at least you have a copy of the reports. Okay.
Okay. Okay. Yes. And thank Maggie for us.
Or if you have individual questions, you can send them to Brittany and then we can cover them at the next meeting as well. Or we could just cover them overall at the next meeting.
Okay. Sounds great.
Okay. Thank you.
Yeah. Thanks, Carlos.
Frank. I'm not able to share.
Oh, I'm so sorry, Frank. Let me make you a co-host.
Chris, I'm going to have to leave at 5:15 just to let you know when I disappear.
Okay. Thanks.
There you are, Frank.
I think you can all see that screen now. Yes?
Yes.
Okay, good.
Very small.
Yeah, so I'll expand it a little more so that you can actually see in a bit. So this is for Silverbell Puppetry. The Silverbell Landfill, which was operating between 1966 and 1977. And then after it closed in 1999, it became a wharf site. So we had groundwater contamination from the landfill. And again, the contaminants of concern were the typical PC, TNTC, and vinyl chloride. So this site has been monitored since 1985, the groundwater. And then we started the groundwater extraction and treatment system was constructed between 2018 and 2019. And it actually started operation in April of 2020. The treatment consists of granulated active carbon absorption. We have two large vessels of 20,000 pounds each. And we have three extraction wells, extraction well 11, extraction well 12, and extraction well 13. So let me make this a little bigger so that you can kind of get an idea. If you look at the green area here, this is the actual footprint of the landfill. And then this over here on this side is the sweet water recharge basins. And extraction well 11 is here. You see that. Oops. 12 is in this area and 13 is in this area. So I'll show you in a bit a different screenshot of why these extraction wells are located in that specific area. All the treated water that comes through the treatment system, once it's treated, then it goes to the sweet water recharge facility. It's piped over and then it's recharged over here. It actually goes through the treatment system. Well, it currently operates at about 866 gallons per minute. We've treated about 1.9 billion gallons already since it started, and we've removed 917 pounds of chlorinated VOCs, which include the PC, TC, and vinyl chloride. We currently have a Geosyntec, a consultant that operates the actual treatment system. And then we have a separate company that does the groundwater treatment or the groundwater sampling. We wanted to intentionally keep them separate so that from the groundwater sampling over time, we can determine how the system is operating. So we kind of wanted to keep that separation so that there wouldn't be any conflict of interest. The second figure that I'm showing here is if you look at these contours, it just basically shows the flow of the groundwater, which goes from the southeast to the northwest. If I'm going too fast, just let me know. So this one was when the system started, when we didn't have the treatment facility. So you can just see that the groundwater is just flowing freely. And then this one is after the treatment started, and it's actually current as of November of 2023. And you can see where there's some depressions here in the extraction wells, and then where the groundwater is sort of being pulled into those extraction wells. And the extraction wells are here. This one, is that big enough for everyone? It shows the contamination plume. The yellow one here is the one that we are treating. It's basically PCE at this point. And you can see that this was the original plume. It's kind of a little bit spread out, and it was up to like 150 parts per million, 50 and 5. You see this one down here, this one in the Silvercroft, and I'm going to cover that one in a bit after Silver Bell. But this one is a Kinder Morgan contamination. Currently, this is what our plume looks like. So here are our extraction wells. We have the small contamination ring here of 50, and then this one is 4 or 5 parts per million. So we have actually treated a lot of it and we're containing it with them, our extraction wells, so it's easily better managed. You can see that we have this outline, little groundwater plume of PCE, and this one is further out, as you can see the interstate. It's just west of that. There's always been a question of whether this one has actually ever been part of the lab for contamination. We don't know, but there's also the Miracle Mile plume that is east of the interstate. So this could possibly be part of that. This one here just shows more of the deeper intermediate groundwater. This was the original plume, how it looked like. We're treating not only the shallow groundwater, but also intermediate. And this is what it looks like currently. So it's slightly contained and smaller and less contamination. I'm done with that one. Any questions?
Any questions for Frank? That was a good field trip back in the day.
Frank, all the little turquoise circles are monitoring wells, or are they private wells at the bottom of the slide?
These over here? So these are part of, yes. So they are monitoring wells, and there are all of these are part of the Kinder Morgan contamination.
Why are they so close together?
That's a good question. I'm not sure. All I can say is that the contamination was, I don't know. I believe it's
it's because that's where the break was in the pipeline. So they kind of surrounded it to test whichever way it was flowing.
Wow, because they're just on top of each other. I mean, just seems incredible to have sort of put so many resources into that many wells. I mean, normally you do it in a, you know, circular pattern or oblong the way the groundwater flows, but you can see the three outliers out beyond the green, I don't know, apple.
Right.
But the others are just seems incredible. Okay, thank you.
This is more of where the actual break was. And then these other ones were just to try to gauge where the plume was going.
Yeah.
Okay. I'll just jump into Kinder Morgan, which was we call it the Silvercroft wash release. That rupture happened in 2003, July 30th, 2003. Not only there were groundwater, but there was soil contamination as well. And most of it was BTEX, gasoline, and MTBE. The surface contamination was excavated, and then that was removed and disposed of. But then they still had some soil vapor extraction system that they set up for the material that ended up going further into the soil. So they operated that all the way to February of 2017. They did receive a no further action determination from ADEQ for the soil vapor extraction system. So they ended that remediation. But there was still some food product that was extracted from 2003 to 2006 that made it to Uganda. It has been monitored pretty much every quarter since 2007. That plume has been very well delineated. They know exactly where it is, and you can see in this figure. So here's the watch, silver cloth watch. But the red plume is the benzene at this point, and then the MTBE would be the green. One of the concerns that we had and why we've been following this is because the potential that the MTBE plume will commingle with our contamination. And if it reaches our extraction wells, then it would also be extracted from the groundwater and going through our treatment system. And our system would not treat MTBE very well. So in order to, and there was a pushback over the years as to have Kinder Morgan do something about it. So they went ahead and they put in a pilot air spark system, which is basically they drill some additional wells. And in this area, you can see all these wells here, these yellow ones. But the intent of that was to inject air so that oxygen would help the microbes break down the MTBE. MTBE can be naturally broken down by the microbes. And a lot of the reason why this plume didn't move further northwest towards ours was because it was being naturally attenuated and remediated by the microbes. But it was still slightly moving. So they needed to stop it basically, until eventually over the years it gets completely eliminated and remediated. After their pilot spark system was installed and operated, then they found that it was working. It operated from October 20 through December 21. In 2023, ADEQ issued a groundwater remediation action plan so that to make this more of a permanent remediation system. So the air spark system continues to operate and they keep monitoring the groundwater, what's called monitor for natural attenuation. Okay, that's all I have. Any questions?
Brittany, do you think you could just send us some of these so that we can look at them closer?
Sure, no problem.
Yeah. And then we can check out the notes as well. So thanks, Frank.
Sure.
All right. Let's move on to item 7. And let's see, Trevor, are you going to give us an update from our subcommittee meeting?
Happy to do it. Since I am the one that stands between us and call the audience, I will go quick. We got a quick update on the MRF report. We are standardizing plastic prices or rather the rebates we're getting for plastic. Because Republic Services is sending, I forget which types, but I think it was 2, 3, and 4 or 2, 3, and 5, something like that, to a polymer facility up in Las Vegas, and they're turning that plastic into plastic flakes. And that process is supposed to be a little bit more circular than traditional recycling of plastics. In public outreach, Christina and her team have been doing a lot of tour, or sorry, a lot of events, a lot of outreach. We had, of course, the tour on the 31st. Zero Waste Collection event on the 2nd did really, really well. It was our biggest yet, and we had 528 cars come through, and all of the vendors that we were partnering with filled up and had to leave early. A few other events, but all very good. For code enforcement, we had two new people start. We are right around 15 or 16 inspectors total. We are down to one CSO because one of those CSOs turned into a full inspector. Few updates on the vans and lanes for foreclosure projects seem to be going well overall. Got some updates on the enforcement process for work without permits. Not a huge difference in the process overall, but some good updates about how things are now working. Into collections, we pretty much all got the same update that Carlos gave earlier. A lot of struggles with brush and bulky, especially with illegal dumping, and we had quite a conversation around potential solutions to that. Moving on to equipment, we're still waiting on some equipment that we purchased in fiscal year 23. Of course, still waiting on some from fiscal year 24, but we're expecting quite a bit of equipment to come in by the end of the year. On to the Los Reales Sustainability Campus, landfill operations, we're back depositing waste in Cell 4B. We installed our first layer of collectors for landfill gas and now can continue putting waste back in. We did have an accident out at the landfill. We had a water truck that the back half of it rolled over, but everyone was okay. And then on bifusion, we are still waiting on some permits to start construction on the facility. And once that is taken care of, we'll start building out the roads shell for the building itself and the parking lots. And we are still storing hard to recycle plastics at the landfill. We have around 240 bales, but we are no longer storing anything at Freeman. That's it.
Thank you. Let's move quickly to item 8, future agenda items.
I have none.
None. Anyone else? No. Okay. Item 9, call to audience. Kevin, I assume you have something to tell us.
Thank you. Appreciate the opportunity to speak to the committee. My name is Kevin Green, and I serve on Sustainable Tucson's Zero Waste Committee. And today, I'd like to share our views on the Hefty Renew Orange Bag program. I wish I'd done this a couple of months ago after we issued our report on the program, but better late than never, I guess. Our first concern is that we're puzzled that the city is partnering with two companies that have a vested interest in perpetuating throwaway systems and single-use habits. Dow Chemical, one of the sponsors of the Hefty Renew program, makes a variety of plastic resins, such as polyethylene, polypropylene, and polystyrene. The other industry sponsor, Reynolds Consumer Products, makes a variety of disposable consumer products, including garbage bags, plastic wrap, plastic cups, and disposable tableware. Unfortunately, the Hefty Renew program ties in with the fossil fuel industry's interest in tripling plastic production by 2060, largely to flood the marketplace with even more single-use packaging. The oil and chemical companies are betting big on petrochemicals and plastics in particular to preserve their profit margins as the world moves to renewable energy and electric vehicles. The program also lets consumer brand companies off the hook for developing more sustainable product delivery systems, such as reuse refill systems and non-toxic packaging. Perhaps the biggest flaw with the Hefty Renew program is that it doesn't address the life cycle impacts of plastic. As you may know, plastic is a problem for the environment and public health long before it becomes waste or litter in our community. Plastic is an incredibly high pollution product. It's made from fossil fuel chemicals that are extracted from the ground through fracking and other methods. Refining those chemicals into plastic resin is an energy intensive process that generates huge amounts of greenhouse gases. In fact, if plastic production were a country, it would be the fifth largest emitter of greenhouse gases in the world. Plastic production also releases a host of toxic chemicals into the air, water, and soil, such as benzene, toluene, and xylene. These pollutants pose a significant health threat to nearby communities, people living next to petrochemical and plastic production complexes are at a higher risk for cancer, respiratory ailments, and asthma. We don't believe plastic is a sustainable building material. And we don't believe it should be burned to create energy or fuel. Not only are plastics made from fossil fuels, but they contain thousands of different chemical additives, many of which are hazardous to human health, such as flame retardants, bisphenols, phthalates, and PFAS compounds. In conclusion, Sustainable Tucson believes the Hefty Renew program is a diversion from the path to sustainability for the community. Frankly, we're not asking the right questions in Tucson when it comes to how to deal with plastic, with a plastic pollution problem. Instead of asking what can we do with plastic waste after the fact, a better question would be to ask, how do we prevent the waste from being created in the first place? I put a link in the chat to our report on the Hefty Renew program, and it does contain a series of recommendations for how the city can begin to deal with plastic pollution, with a plastic pollution problem in a sustainable and climate resilient manner. Again, thank you for this opportunity to speak to the advisory
committee. Okay, thank you. All right. I think that we're going to be able to adjourn unless anybody's thought up any future agenda items since, but let's go ahead and adjourn. It's 5:24 and thank you all for coming to the meeting, and thank you to the presenters. Appreciate that.
Thanks, everybody. Take care.
Bye.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.